Morning, everybody. Just so you know, you're at Welton Baptist when you've got to move broccoli out of the way so that you can do your talk. What is that? Okay. Very good to see you. I'm going to share a couple of stories before we get into today's talk. First of all, I want to tell you about a mate of my dad, who he grew up with, and his mate John, my dad was called Brian, his mate John was looking for work, and he was in his early 20s, and he couldn't really get work anywhere. So eventually he found a bar where he could get a little bit of part-time work. But the thing is, John wasn't much of a drinker, so he didn't really know much about, you know, the pub game or the bar game, but he really needed this work. And John always told this story of the fact that a bloke came in one day and asked for a dragon's breath cocktail. That's what a dragon's breath cocktail looks like. You can see the smoke in it, or dry ice, whatever it is. John had no idea what one of these was, right? And so to deal with that, he looked this man dead in the eye who'd asked for one and said that he was very sorry, but the dragons hadn't been delivered that day. And apparently, you don't really wish you were there for something. But apparently this bloke went, "Oh, okay, mate," and then just turned around and walked out. And it worked. So he tells that story. And John managed to kind of get away with it. Sorry, I've just found another bit of broccoli. Can I have that? Second story. Now, I apologise if you've heard this before. This is one of my favourite things of all time, but it's about basically being a bit of a fraud. And there's a man called Hugh Gallagher who was desperate to go to university in the States, yet he knew that his ability to be able to write some of the stuff that the big universities in the country would want, he just realised he didn't have the ability to do that. So he thought he would just go long and try his luck with something, right? And so this is an answer to an essay that he was required to ask. So this is what was at the top of the application form. It says, in order for the admission staff of our college to get to know you, this is actually NYU, this was New York University, to get to know you, the applicant, better, we want you to answer the following questions. Are there any significant experiences you've had or accomplishments that you've realised that have helped to define you as a person? And Hugh looked at his life and realised that he had nothing to say. But it didn't stop him. He came up with this. I'm a dynamic figure, often seen scaling walls and crushing ice. I've been known to remodel train stations on my lunch breaks, making them more efficient in the area of heat retention. I translate ethnic slurs for Cuban refugees. I write award-winning operas. I manage time efficiently, and occasionally I tread water for 3 days in a row. I woo women with my sensuous and godlike trombone playing. I can pilot bicycles up severe inclines with unflagging speed, and I cook 30-minute brownies in 20 minutes. I'm an expert in plastering, a veteran in love, and an outlaw in Peru. Using only a hoe and a large glass of water, I once single-handedly defended a small village in the Amazon basin from a horde of ferocious army ants. I play bluegrass cello. I was scouted by the Mets. I am the subject of numerous documentaries. When I'm bored, I build large suspension bridges in my yard. I enjoy urban hang gliding. On Wednesdays after school, I repair electrical appliances free of charge. I'm an abstract artist, a concrete analyst, and a ruthless bookie. Critics worldwide swoon over my original line of corduroy evening wear. I don't perspire. I am a private citizen, yet I receive fan mail. I've been caller number 9 and I've won the weekend passes. Last summer I toured New Jersey with a travelling centrifugal force demonstration. I bat 400. My deft floral arrangements have earned me fame in international botany circles. Best bit by far, children trust me. I can hurl tennis rackets at small moving objects with deadly accuracy. I once read Paradise Lost. Moby Dick and David Copperfield in one day and still had time to refurbish an entire dining room that evening. I know the exact location of every food item in the supermarket. I have performed several covert operations for the CIA. I sleep once a week, and when I do sleep, I sleep in a chair. While on vacation in Canada, I successfully negotiated with a group of terrorists who seized a small bakery. The laws of physics do not apply to me. I balance, I weave, I dodge, I frolic, and my bills are all paid. And on weekends, to let off steam, I participate in full contact origami. Years ago, I discovered the meaning of life. I forgot to write it down. I've made extraordinary four-course meals using only a mooley in a toaster oven. I breed prize-ridden clams. I have won bullfights in San Juan, cliff diving competitions in Sri Lanka, and spelling bees at the Kremlin. I have played Hamlet. I've performed open-heart surgery, and I've spoken with Elvis. But I haven't been to college. Apparently, he got in off the back of that. Today, I want to talk a little bit about feeling like a fraud. Now, I don't know if that's something that kind of resonates with your heart, whether that plagues you at some level, but I often feel like one of the things that we can feel in this Christian life is feeling like having a massive imposter syndrome. And in this kind of perpetual in and out that can happen in our lives, I have found that I am increasingly being challenged about who God says I am. And the fact that feeling like a fraud can be one of the most powerful and, I think, destructive lies that we can kind of hold in ourselves. Because maybe, despite your faith in Jesus, you feel like you just don't measure up at some level. Maybe you don't feel like somehow you perform well, like you're working overtime at some level to gain approval of others, and at the same time, you don't feel like you're doing enough to please God. And that kind of biblical truth that God loves you is being overrun by suspicions that most of you is loved, but there is some parts of you that are unlovable and that you cannot trust that God's grace is more powerful than your sin or disconnection from him. And as a result, maybe you kind of ride this emotional roller coaster of spiritual successes and failures. And if you've got a good day, you feel proud. And maybe even in the worst moments, you feel like you're doing better than the person next to you who hasn't figured it out yet. And then if you have those bad days, you kind of descend into a bit of a shame spiral and wonder if you've disqualified yourself from God's love. Maybe that's the spaces that you operate inside. And the common theme on both those good and those bad days is the need to hide from God and others because you feel like a fraud. It's like you call yourself a Christian, but there are ugly parts of you that you don't want anyone to know about. So today I'm calling our talk, Fraud and God, How to Get Over Imposter Syndrome. So to start off, I want us to look at a little bit out of the Gospel of Luke, and it says this is when Jesus calls his first disciples, and it says this. One day, as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the people were crowded around him and listening to the word of God, and he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little bit from the shore. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. And when Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, because I'm a sinful man." For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. And then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on you will fish for people." So they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. Now, whenever we read the Bible, it's very important to understand the context of when things were written, when the context of the story was written. And the culture at the time of Jesus, as you know, or we probably know, was a Jewish context. And people in the region of where we're talking about here grew up in an Orthodox Jewish setting. Now, if you were part of that society, there were very strict rules and systems and kind of structures around education. And the idea was that at 6 years old, you were taken into school and you were taught the first five books of the Bible, what's called the Torah. It's part of your kind of education. And the idea was that you remembered it. You would learn it by rote. And that would kind of go in. And that first bit of education was called Bet Sefer. It meant the house of the book. And that was from age 6 to 10 years old. And they had five classes a week, a bit like we do at the moment. But the Jewish people found that they said that this was one of the most important things that you could do with children, because it was a reminder of not only what God had done in the past for your people, but also it was your heritage. It was yours to take further into your setting. So it was very, very important. And most kids, by the time they got to 10 years old, were finished with school at that point because they'd learnt what they needed to. And then you were kind of released to go back into whatever the family trade was. But there were some kids who were showing just a little bit more inside that setting. They were kids who were showing not only the fact that they could do perfect recitation, but they were showing quite a lot of understanding as well about what they were reading. And so they had a second chance to kind of learn. And it was called the Bet Talmud. It meant the house of learning. And that was from age 10 to 14 years. And there they studied the rest of the Hebrew scriptures, essentially our Old Testament, so from book 5 onwards. And they memorized all the rest of it. So by the age of 14, by rote, they had memorized the entirety of the Old Testament. Can you imagine having that in your head? But they also learned this Jewish art of kind of asking good questions and answers and wrestling with what the scriptures meant as well. But there was one more layer after Bet Talmud, and it was called Bet Midrash. It was called the House of Study, but very, very few students made it that far. And if you were smart enough and knew your scriptures well enough to make it that far, you were given the opportunity to spend time or connect with a rabbi or kind of a teacher to seek further education. And that rabbi would grill you, and he would kind of ask you loads of questions because he was trying to find out if you were good enough to be his student or not. He wanted to know if you knew enough, but even more importantly, if you could be like him in all the areas of your life. And he decided whether you should go with him or whether you should go back to your family business. It was very rare, but if he thought highly enough of you, he would become your teacher, and it would become your life goal to become like him in every way of your life. And you would agree to kind of take on his beliefs if you decided to go into that way of life. And you would go into his understanding and interpretations of the scriptures. They used to call it his yoke. That was what it was called. And he would say to you, "Come, follow me." And that was a huge privilege to be offered that in that society. And it was given to very, very few students, very few people. And those disciples, as they were called, would become like the rabbi in every way. You know, it even has, I was reading some history around it, and there were rabbis who might have had a limp. And sometimes you would even see healthy disciples mimic him as he was going around. That's how revered these people were. So when we drop into this story about these first boys who were doing their work, Jesus is teaching people, and Luke is very, very deliberately telling us that Peter was a fisherman. He's telling us by inference that Peter wasn't picked. He wasn't the star pupil. In fact, he was likely not to have made it past age 10 inside the education setting, and he'd been sent home to learn the family trade. So you can imagine the power of this rabbi coming along, looking at him and saying, join me. Do you see the context of that? It's incredibly powerful. The honor and recognition of a rabbi calling you would literally make you drop everything. Look at this in Matthew. Matthew phrases it not only about Peter, but also about Andrew, James, and John. Very similar, but he just embellishes it. He pulls it apart a bit more. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, Jesus said, and I'll send you out to fish for people. And at once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. And they were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. All of these boys were underachievers. All of them were underachievers. To any onlooker, they would have looked like complete frauds. And yet Jesus calls them. Jesus calls them. You know, I think a lot about those feelings of imposter syndrome in our life is not about whether we feel like we've got enough knowledge or we know how to bluff, but it's about how important we see we are in this story, about the way that God speaks about us. Because I want us to start realizing how he's calling us and where we're from. Because I think that when we say to God, I'm not who you think I am, God says, you're right. You're way better. You're way better than that. So I want to give us a little bit of practical advice if you're up for it. If you've got imposter syndrome like I have in my life. There's a few ideas that maybe you can build into the kind of rhythms of your life. First of all, be grounded in grace. I think most of us are often only acquainted with God's grace. We're not kind of grounded in it. We know about God's grace intellectually at some level, but somehow we live disconnected from it experientially. Instead, I think we depend on our own performance to win over God's affections and the approval of others. To be grounded in grace, I think, means we need to learn that the essence of grace is the safe foundation of God's love, secured in the fact that Jesus died for us. When we feel safe, you can see that your weakness, your failure, your sin and shame, actually, they become an invitation to trust. And when you trust God's grace and depend on him, you're pleasing him, not disappointing him. Your needing God looks like humility. It looks like vulnerability, authenticity. And there's no reason to hide your shame anymore. Being grounded in grace means that you can lean into your limitations and failures and kind of come out of hiding at some level. It's the difference between thinking, oh no, I messed up, I hope that God doesn't find out, and thinking, oh no, I messed up, I need to talk to my father about this. Two very, very different postures and thinking. Secondly, the devil is active in his attack around your identity, which is why I think these feelings are so powerful in our lives. You see, imposter syndrome is a distraction from action. Imposter syndrome stalls and disables you, and imposter syndrome keeps your eyes focused and fixed on your inadequacy. As long as you're preoccupied by thinking about your inability rather than God's ability, you will always live a life restrained by fear and small goals, I think. You know, in John 10:10, Jesus is pretty clear about this stuff. He's talking about the devil here, and he says, the thief only comes to steal and kill and destroy, but I have come that you might have life and have it to the full. Have you ever noticed, for those of you who might struggle with this, that imposter syndrome is always internal? It never works on the outside. If you were to share amongst Christians about the fact that you feel like you're an imposter, we would all encourage you, wouldn't we? We'll say, what are you doing? You shouldn't feel like that. You're incredible, all the rest of it. The devil relies on the fact that it's all internalized, about the fact that you process it and keep it all to yourself. You see how he works? That's how he does his lies. That's how he smashes you down. So we have to be really intentional, I think, in our thought life around this stuff. Because if you start to be crippled by a version of yourself, which doesn't look like Peter and the others being called, I think you're being lied to. I think you're being lied to because you don't say, I belong. I belong in your calling. I belong to who you say I am. I think it's very important that we start to understand that you, that we have been called by the Most High, even though we feel completely ineffective. Thirdly, only compare yourself to the person that you were yesterday. I've spoken about comparison reasonably recently. I think it's been on my heart a lot. I think it's incredibly toxic. I think it's incredibly cancerous. Because when Jesus recruited his team, he chose according to what he saw, not about how they felt about themselves or what their society said about them. You're only responsible for your own walk. Listen for that voice of the divine calling you. So I come into land to tell you a story, which I think is one of the most beautiful ways I've ever heard about a child being taken in by the society that they're in. It's from these people called the Himba, and they live in Namibia. And to them, the date of a child, or the date of birth of a child, isn't fixed. It's not on the day that they were born or their arrival in the world. It's actually much earlier. They refer to the start of a child as the day that the mother thought about that child. And when a woman decides she's going to have a child, she settles down and she rests underneath a tree of her own picking. And she listens until she hears the song of a child who wants to be born. And after she's heard that child's song, she comes back to the man who will be the father of the child to teach him that song. And they sing the song together as they try to conceive. And then eventually, if it happens, when the mother is pregnant, she teaches the singing of this child to the midwives and the older women of the village. And then when the child is born, old women and people around him sing the song to welcome him into the world. And as the child grows, the other villagers learn the song as well. So if the child falls down or gets hurt, he will always find someone to pick him up and sing his song to him. Similarly, if the child does something wonderful or successfully passes through the rites of passage, the people of the village sing the song of that boy or that child, that girl, back to them. And in the tribe, if there's another opportunity where villagers sing for the child, if at any point during his life the kid or the young person commits a crime or a social act that doesn't kind of fit with their own systems, the individual is called to the center of the village and the people of the community form a circle around him and they sing his song to him to remind him of the fact that actually that's who he is. That's where he comes from, and that's a reminder of his identity and in the fact that he's been loved even before he came into being. When you recognize your own song, you don't want or need to do anything that would harm the other person, and in the same way through their lives in marriage, songs are sung together. And when that young person, when that person gets old and the kid's lying in his bed and he's ready to die, that kid being an old person by then maybe, all the villagers know his song and they sing and they come around him for the last time and they sing that song over him as he dies. I tell you all that because I think God has sung a song over you for your whole life. Don't be robbed of any of it. When he thinks about you, he sees you like that. Life in all its fullness is what Jesus offered. If any of this stuff has kind of really connected with you today, as Matt has shared and Elspeth has talked about it, we would love to pray for you. If there's any part of this that's kind of, oh, I feel like a fraud, I get it, you're in good company, but Jesus sings a song over us and he calls us and says that you're enough. Amen.